I've spoken at a lot of graduation exercises, and there are many secrets. In the Old Testament, it speaks of a number of secrets, but one of the great secrets is what people wear under their academic robes. And the largest graduation exercise I ever was involved in was at North Carolina State University a few years ago. And about as far as you could see, there were people, some 15,000, I suppose, some 4,500 graduates. And they wanted a veterinarian to speak because it was a new veterinary school and this was their first graduating class. But there was resistance on the part of the chancellor and the president, because some years before they had a Nobel Prize winner who will remain nameless. He's a friend of mine, but he bombed out, and so they were opposed to any biologist or somebody from the field of medicine. I ended up there, and to show you how crazy I am, I told them what I told you, that, you know, one of the great secrets which I was about to reveal is what people wear under their academic robes. Sometimes it isn't very much. And I told them that here's one of the things we wear, the people in medicine wear. You see, they got and I didn't bring it along, but you see, it's a tie painted on there. You have your stethoscope, all your instruments, and all the numbers for tests, and you're all equipped. But the point of this was, of course, that you need more than that if you're going to be a successful practitioner. And the knowledge and the instruments is not enough. But then I revealed to them what old men wear under their... and it's the same as the one I'm wearing here. Old age and treachery will overcome youth and skill. And then I told them, and what I did, you see, I had all these things on, then I'd pulled out another one, you see, and told them what old Norwegians wear under their robes, you see. Well, by this time, the president of the university was pale, and the chancellor for the whole system was rubbing his hands and wondering, you know, and probably sweating. I'd rather you wouldn't ask me if they've invited me back, but we had a great time. In fact, Chancellor Friday said, I'm going to take some of that because I have to speak to University of North Carolina next week. But he didn't borrow it was significant, he didn't borrow my undergarments. But it was an interesting exercise, and to be involved in graduation, because they're always happy events, especially for those who graduate. And also for the parents, they can quit writing checks and stuff. That was the largest celebration I've ever been involved in graduation. The smallest one was at Colotus, Washington, which is the end of the world. I'd been through it 500 times, but never stopped over a period of many years. They called me up 2 years ahead of time, says, "We want you to speak to our graduation exercise." I'll admit, we only have 6 graduates. And I says, you know, it's time I'm stopping there. So I says, okay, I'll be there. So I went charging out there 2 years later. And it's out in nowhere. I think there was a gas station in town and a tavern. And they apologized that the tavern owner wasn't there. He had to keep it open. But everybody else was for 50 miles around. The gymnasium was full. And it was the most impressive ceremony that I'd really been to. The The boys were blue and the girls wore yellow, as I recall, and they didn't march up. They'd drag one foot and then go like this, you know, to the music. And I mean, it was class. It was a class affair. Everybody got awards, but they apologized. There was only five graduating, but I told them I'd do it anyway, since I was already there. But they also threw in the eighth grade graduates. And then afterwards, we all marched down front, and everybody came up and told me they were going to send their children to WSU. And I signed them up. So that's the preliminaries. And you can turn on the lights now. I probably better cover this up, because it may not be true. And I am very uncomfortable with this situation. Some people asked me if I wouldn't wear this, but I can't see very well. I can't see very well with it, but it's worse with it than without it. So I'll save that for my pig talk on Thursday. But my trouble with tonight is that we're still in the preliminaries. And I think it's well illustrated in something I got last week. It's written by an elderly lady, and she says, "Frankly, I've become quite a frivolous old gal. I'm seeing five gentlemen every day. As soon as I wake up, Will Power helps me get out of bed. Then I go and see John. Then Charlie Horse comes along, and when he is here, he takes a lot of time and attention. And when he leaves, Arthur Ritus shows up and stays the rest of the day. He doesn't like to stay in one place very long, so he takes me from joint to joint. After such a busy day, I'm really tired and glad to go to bed with Ben Gay. What a life. P.S. The preacher came to call the other day, and he said, at my age, I should be thinking about the hereafter. I told him, I do that all the time, no matter where I am, in the parlor upstairs and in the kitchen or down the basement. I ask myself, why am I hereafter? And I sympathize with her, and I identify with her. For now, in many years, I've gone down to the basement to get something, and before I got to the final step, I'd forgotten what I was here after. Now, at first, I was usually in a hurry, and I'd run back upstairs. But then my wife would say, you forgot what you went after, didn't you, you know? Well, I got wise to that in a hurry. And now, when I go down there, I've forgotten by the time I get to the last stair. So I sit down there, think about it for a while. Unfortunately, we have a John downstairs. So if all else fails, I go to the John, and so it's not all lost. So, but you see, the point of this story is that, and as Jackie said, you know, he gets up and he tells some of the same stories every day. Well, you see, I make a deal with people that want to tape me. They can tape me if they don't make me listen to it. See? And like today, a lady came to me and says, I was listening to a tape, something from the Funny File, and I didn't even know it was here. And I think I'm responsible for it. But I declare incompetence. So you won't sue me. Now, we have a lot of things to get through tonight. You can leave any time you wanna. But I hope a couple of you stay till the end. The sermon text tonight is from something Ken and Lois Erickson gave me. They put together, they know somebody that put together Laughter, the Best Medicine. And the sermon text is from Proverbs 17, 21 and 23. A cheerful heart is good medicine. And on 23, be cheerful, keep healthy. It keeps you healthy. It is slow death to be gloomy all the time. So that's why I'm here. And for you, also to depart from my unprepared text, for you birders, there's an eccentric down at Cannon Beach, Oregon, who spends his entire time throwing rocks at gulls. He leaves no turn unstoned. Now, I'm really here to inform Elder Hostel. So I feel a real obligation to them. And a lot of them aren't Lutherans. And that doesn't surprise me, because a lot of Lutherans don't want to admit they're old enough to go to Elder Hostel. And a lot of the others have forgotten how old they are. So I thought it would be fitting and proper to tell you some of the characteristics of Lutherans, which I've shared with some of you before. I won't share them all with you, but I've picked out quite a few. Luther's cradle hymn, "And a Mighty Fortress Is Our God," better than anybody else. Lutherans generally have less money than Episcopalians, but more than Nazareans and Independent Baptists. Lutherans have more fun than Seventh-day Adventists. Lutherans not only make better coffee than almost anyone, but they make more of it. Lutherans believe in the importance of confession and frequently confess their sins, especially when confronted with the evidence. Lutherans trust other Lutherans except in matters of judging what is best for the church. Lutherans are uncomfortable around Roman Catholics who go to church more often than they do. Lutherans believe in ecumenism because they want everybody else to become like Lutherans. Lutherans enjoy church suppers and will pay as much as $1.50 or $2 for the privilege of bringing their family to one. Lutherans usually don't use church suppers to raise money for the church budget, but smorgasbords are exempt from such rules. Lutherans are the only people I know who cook lutefisk in the church basement. Most of the others do it outside, quite a ways away from any buildings. Lutheran men aren't sure what Lutheran church women are or do, but they think it's a good thing. Lutherans wonder a lot about people named Larson, Olson, Schroeder, and Schultz who belong to other churches. They also wonder about people named O'Toole, Monahan, and Gambini, who are members of the Lutheran Church. Lutherans dress better than Unitarians on Sunday mornings. Lutherans who have never been on a church council claim that they don't know what goes on at the council meetings. Lutherans on the council claim they don't either. I believe it is wrong to vote for a candidate, or Lutherans believe it is wrong to vote for a candidate on purely religious grounds, unless, of course, the candidate happens to be Lutheran. And Lutherans believe in miracles, but expect them only during stewardship drives. Lutherans believe in offering an honorarium for guest speakers, and if they decline it, they will invite the speaker again. I found that out by experience. Lutherans believe it's okay to poke fun at themselves. If they didn't, I wouldn't have tried or told you what I've just told you. Now I want to start from the beginning. That's a good place to begin. I was born at a very tender age in a place called Snooze Hill, which is near Stanwood, Washington. And the community is so small that the zip code is EIEIO. And there are a couple from the same area. They live in the suburbs of Snooze Hill, and they'll confirm this. Ray Scrindy and Peggy Nelson. You will, won't you? I was steeped in Norwegian tradition since my parents came from Norway, and Norwegian was my first language. And my intention tonight, briefly, is to tell you about some of the humorous and interesting fun times I've had in the last 70 years. I said Norwegian was my first language, but it wasn't pure Norwegian, because we were on a party line. Our number was five short. I knew all the other numbers. And when our folks weren't present, we'd do what we call rubbernecking. You'd cover the mouthpiece and hold the earpiece to your ear, and then you'd hope that the dog wouldn't bark, because I knew all the dogs in the area, and when I was calling up, I could tell who was listening in by of their dog bark, you see. But you see, the point of this is that, you see, there were not only Norwegians on this line, but there were Danes and Swedes. So I got, so I could handle a little bit of Swede and a little bit of Danish that way, and you'd kind of mix it up too. So that's why my Norwegian isn't very pure. Although I had a real test on it. My first trip to Scandinavia was to participate in the International Congress in Stockholm in 1953. I hadn't yet been to Norway, which wasn't setting very good priorities, but I was there anyway at Stockholm first. And I was having trouble with the person in the restaurant to understand my English. So I switched to Norwegian. And her face lighted up, and she says, "Du er for god, Bransdalen," meaning, you have the Ozark twang of a place in Norway, you see? I mean, but it was the language of 1900 when my father came here, you see? So I felt pretty good about that. But then I went from there to Norway to speak at their annual meeting. And I did some of it in Norwegian. I will never do that again. But it was a diplomatic success. And they wrote it up in the Oslo papers. Told about this character who had never been there, but his folks were born there, and he gave this scientific dissertation in a frisk Gudbrandsdalen dialect, a fresh Ozark twang, you see. And after I finished my talk, they came up and told me what a great job I had done. But as the evening wore out, and the aquavit bottles were gone, they came around and told me all the mistakes I made, you see, and deflated me. But I did learn quite a bit, and one of them was, I'll never do that again. But it was fun. That takes care of that page. My youth was interesting. Sometimes I felt sort of put down as a Norwegian because the Swedes were always telling bad jokes. And I'll just give you one example of this. It was told about old Mackelboost, old man Mackelboost, who had been to the East Side Tavern and was coming home late, walking home late. It's quite a long walk, and he went into the wrong. Instead of going into his own, he went. Who did I say, Mackelboost or Hammerwald? Well, the other one. He went to the wrong place in a way, and he picked the first building and went in, which happens to be the Hog House, and laid down by the first body he found, and said, "Är du svensk?" Meaning, are you Swede, you see? And all he got out of it was, "Norsk, norsk, norsk." And I took offense at that. In the remarkable matins today, talking about playing hide and seek, That was very impressive to me. But we didn't play a lot of hide and seek. We played more kick the can, which is a great one. And we were recycling cans. I want you to tell Al Pitcher this. We were recycling cans in 1929. I mean, we'd kick the can, but we were using cans that had been used before, but then we'd bloom them out again so we could keep kicking them, you see. So I want you to tell him that. But I found out, I realized, because we didn't play hide-and-seek very much, because if there were a lot of Norwegians there and a few others, and a couple of Swedes, the Swedes would go and hide, and we never found them. We didn't look for them, in fact. And I found out from Howie today that he'd been to Sweden and found out they'd hardly ever play hide-and-seek there. Even the Swedes don't look for the Swedes. And that was quite a revelation to me. Now, a few facts that I learned about all this. And one of the very disturbing things I have to tell you about is that when I started school, and when I got to school, I knew some English because my brother was ahead of me. When he went to school, he didn't know any English. But he taught me some, and my folks were trying to get us to speak English or American too. But it wasn't very long in school before they told me that Christopher Columbus discovered America. Now that, I'm telling you, was very upsetting, because in our living room there was a picture of Leif Erikson in his boat on American shore, you see, North American shore. Probably about 900. And they kept telling about Christopher Columbus, who was a Johnny-come-lately. In fact, I had to correct somebody just 2 days ago in Bible class. They were saying about Christopher Columbus discovering America. So I hope you help me in this. And on Columbus Day, don't wish anybody happy Columbus Day. Send them a Leif Erikson postcard. So that's how I really learned about who discovered America. I never did find out who discovered Norway. But from legitimate Norwegian sources, I found out who discovered Sweden. That was the Roto-Rooter man. Now, I've often asked why so many Norwegians came to America. And it was a mystery to me that why people would want to leave Norway. And the reason finally came to me within the last decade. And it seems that, and this really clarifies another thing for you, because I used to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. And I was told that St. Patrick was commemorated because he drove the snakes out of Ireland. And the truth of the matter is, he was really rewarded because he drove the Norwegians out of Ireland. And it went something like this. Many years ago, when things were tough in Norway and the winters were cold, quite a few of them went down to Ireland. And they didn't make out too well there. The Irish were very wicked off with them because things were tough in Ireland. And the Norwegians sort of cornered all the fish and left the Irish with the spuds. This went on for quite a while, and old St. Patrick formed the Eritreon, the Irish Republican Army, to rid Ireland of Norwegians. And they were well organized, and so what they did, they went into the cold storage where the Norwegians kept the fish and messed up the cold storage system so the fish got warm and spoiled. But what the Irish didn't know is that Norwegians love spoiled fish. So it says, we'll fix them. And so they went in there in the dark of night and put lye all over those fish. Well, what the Irish didn't know is that's how they make lutefisk. And so they relished that. And what made matters worse, there were more and more Norwegians, and they then started getting the potatoes to make lefse to go with the lutefisk. So they were running out of spuds too, and they were out of fish. So old St. Patrick finally, you know, he'd had enough of this. He didn't know what to do, so he told the Norwegians to go to hell. And they did. They went to North Dakota. So that's how that happened. Now, there's a couple other little facts here you should probably know. I've told some of you about it before, but and I've suggested it, but I still don't see it in the ice cream bar here. It's the most famous Scandinavian drink. It's made out of prune juice and 7-Up, and it's called Hurry Up. So, Norwegians have a unique garbage disposal system. It's a pig under the sink. My next to last visit in Norway was a few years ago now, and it was going to celebrate the 17th of May, and I had a speech to give at the University of Oslo on the Friday before the 17th of May, and you can imagine the traffic. This is the biggest celebration in the world, bar none, in all of Norway, no matter where you go. Fantastic celebration. But in this interview, after the interview, they said, we got to go out and find a dog, to have a picture of you with a dog. And I thought this was pretty crazy in the middle of Oslo on this busiest of all days. But they went tearing out, and I figured I wouldn't see them again. But pretty soon they came running back to say, we found the dog. Wasn't much of a dog, but a pretty scrawny dog. But she'd caught up with this lady in the bank, and she agreed that I could have her borrow her dog for a while to have a picture taken. And they introduced me to her, Britt Langley, but she declined to have her picture taken with me. Britt Langley didn't mean anything to me. And they introduced her dog, Pioff. Now, Pioff is named after Edith Pioff. And Britt Langley is one of Norway's leading actresses. And she was playing the part of Edith Pioff in a long-term play in Oslo. And so the next day, in the Oslo papers, here in the front page, a picture of me with this scrawny dog. And I'd been there for a talk. But the gist of this, why I'm telling you this, is there was another family from Pullman, the Josens, who have a lot of connections here, and have their kids here, and they were in, I didn't know they were going to be in Norway, they didn't know I was going to be in Norway, and they were riding the train peacefully, and the people across, sitting across from in the train, had the paper over, reading the paper, and here's my picture with this scrawny dog out there, and I said to you, look at there, there's Busted, that crazy Busted, you can't even get away from him. So that's my story about Pioff. Now, I gotta find out what to do next. Ran out of paper there, so it must be something. Oh, and now I'm gonna go back and sort of chronologically run into some things that I've had to face along the way. In teaching, I was very, very distressed about the deterioration in writing skills. And I was, before I left the University of California, I was also retiring out of the reserves, Medical Service Corps. And I'd had some traffic, and I've been a consultant for the Air Force Surgeon General. So I've had some time in San Antonio. And in the San Antonio Veterans Administration office, they collected up a bunch of parts of letters from inquiries from next of kin or parent, husband or wife or mother or father some of the military personnel, and I'd like to share a few of these with you. Please send me my elopement, as I have a four-month-old baby, and his is my only support, and I need all I can get every day to buy food and keep him close. Both sides of my parents are poor, and I can't expect nothing from them, as my mother has been in bed for 1 year with the same doctor and won't change. Please send me my wife's form to fill out. Please send me a letter and tell me if my husband has made application for a wife and baby. I can't get any pay. I have six children. Can you tell me why this is? I am forwarding you my marriage certificate and my two children. One is a mistake, as you can plainly see. In answer to your letter, I gave birth to a boy weighing 101 pounds. I hope this is satisfactory. You changed my little boy to a little girl. Does this make a difference? In accordance with your instructions, I have given birth to twins in the enclosed envelope. I am glad to say that my husband, who has been reported missing, is now dead. Unless I get my allotment soon, I will be forced to lead an immortal life. And then this last one is my favorite. I have already wrote to the president, and if I don't hear from you, I will write to Uncle Sam and tell him about both of you. When I was in the University of California, it got to be a real craze about about jogging. They quit sitting and started jogging and running. And I sort of got into it too, but I kind of woke up and realized this is a serious issue. And I'd like to share with you what I did about it. Oh, I want to also acknowledge on this thing on Lutherans. That was from the Lutheran Standard many, many years ago. And I did some embellishment to it. And I can give you the reference for it. I also stole a couple of things from somebody on this. I said, in this critical time of energy shortage, I've been examining methods of conserving and utilizing wasted energy. And one of the areas of greatest potential has to do with jogging. Jogging has gotten to be a craze, so I thought it was time to speak up for sitting. The runners claim that it improves health and gives one a euphoric high. It makes one younger and improves one's health and sex life. I wish to make a case for long-term sitting rather than long-distance running. I believe the energy expended and wasted in jogging today probably contributes significantly to our energy crisis. The crazy runners are burning up energy helter-skelter. It isn't that I haven't tried running. You're listening to a reformed jogger. I belong to Joggers Anonymous, J-A, pronounced yaw in Norwegian. I tried running in California. I would go out and run every night outside of Davis, California, and every night I'd come home too pooped to pant. And I was just thankful that I'd gotten home without having a heart attack or being waylaid by a mugger. And I never did develop a stomach for dry heaves. You probably already realize that runners and joggers are braggers. Some joggers have really become overbearing. Without you ever asking them, they tell you how many miles they've run per day, per week, per month, and per year. And after they finish with this fabrication, they tell you about their weight, blood pressure, and pulse rate. They really have a thing about pulse rate. They like to tell you that it's 40 in repose. And when they finish with this fabrication, they like to ask a non-runner what his or her pulse rate is. And I figured out a way to break them of this. Tell them that your pulse rate is the same as your body temperature, 98.6. Nobody ever gives their pulse rate in the decimal. As you say this nonchalantly, take another drink out of your peanut butter chocolate milkshake and take another big bite out of your Twinkie. At this, the jogger will express horror and say, "This is terrible, you're in bad shape." And then you say, "Really?" And you hold your breath until your face turns red, and then you roll your eyes back, slide down to your chair, and make a gurgling sound. And I can assure you that a jogger will never ask you your pulse rate again. Sitters, on the other hand, are very modest. They seldom talk about how great sitting is. They don't wear you out telling how good sitting is. All they say is, "Have a chair." Almost everybody can sit unless they have a recent hemorrhoidectomy or an episiotomy. You can do it alone or with anyone in any kind of weather. You don't need special books to tell you how to do it or any special equipment. In sitting, you don't even need a chair. Some prefer just a log or to sit under a tree or on the lawn. Some prefer a lazy boy rocker with certain life support systems. Now, it must also be healthy to sit. I've seen a lot of physicians, and they're usually sitting, and if they weren't healthy, I don't think they'd be sitting so much. And they're making a lot of money sitting down. With that kind of money, you know they want to stay around and enjoy it for a while. That's why they sit a lot. Now, a word about the hazards, the comparative hazards of sitting versus jogging. Sitters have 92% less strained tendons, broken bones, twisted ankles, torn ligaments, and sore knees. The sitters are hit by 96% fewer cars. They are bitten by 82% fewer dogs. They step in 73% less dog dew. And they're hit on the head by an 86% less starling and pigeon dung. Now, bridle paths for horses are now being taken over by joggers who don't want the horses on them. If the horseback riders insist on using them, they have to wear diapers. Sitters are far more likely to be invited in on a neighbor's rug or being lent a comb. You wouldn't lend a comb to a jogger who's been out running out in the trees and meadows. One should examine the accomplishments, too, of joggers versus sitters. Look at the sitters. The great philosopher and teacher Socrates experimented with running in his youth, but he found that he continued tripping over his toga and took some very bad spills. So he gave it up, concluding that running was not the act of an enlightened person. And thereafter, in all his teaching, he insisted all the students remain seated during lessons, a tradition which continues to the present day. Now, Beethoven, the musician, didn't go out running around. He sat on his piano stool. And Shakespeare, he wasn't out running around for 12 nights before he wrote the 12th night. He wasn't out running on a midsummer night when he wrote A Dream About It. And Newton didn't develop his theories running down the road. He was sitting under an apple tree. And I think of all the great Norwegian sitters, Bjorn Bjornsson, the novelist, and Grieg, the musician. They wrote their compositions sitting down. And Dr. Hansen, who discovered the bacteria that caused leprosy, he did this in Bergen, Norway, sitting in front of his microscope. And Leif Erikson discovered America sitting in a boat. Edison, he invented the light bulb and the phonograph, most of it sitting down. Our country didn't become great by jogging. People on horses pioneered it. I never saw a movie with John Wayne, Randolph Scott, or the Cisco Kid dressed in a tailored jogging suit and wearing special jogging shoes, running after somebody. And I ask you, how would it have looked if the Lone Ranger had slapped himself on his hip and shouted, "Hi-yo, joggers, away!" They would have locked him up, and rightfully so. I say, let the horses stay in the bridle path. Let the joggers learn to leap over the used horse feed. It'll give them some excitement on a dull run. As Marie Antoinette might have said, let them wear boots. My final pitch on this subject is that runners can't get anything done. They're breathing so hard, fighting every breath, just trying to keep from getting bit by a dog or worrying about whether they'll make it home, that they can't do anything else. And with the pain they're feeling, they worry and wonder whether it's a heart attack or just gas. So my plea to the joggers is to do a cost-benefit risk analysis. Respect the energy shortage and conserve energy before it's too late. Help save America. I close with the immortal words of our 30th president, Calvin Coolidge. I do not choose to run. I'm in great debt, two or three of these things out of Mike Royko. I don't know if you've heard him. He's a real curmudgeon. I had a talk with him the other day on the phone. It's hard to get anything out of him, but he does write a great column. Now, I am arriving in Pullman to take up my duties as dean. I came 2 months early. And the first day there, I slipped a disc and ended up 8 days in my back in the hospital. And Somebody got a card about this, what you should do in the hospital. So I embellish that, and I think this you'll find it very helpful. I know it's helped quite a few people, except those that have had appendectomy or abdominal surgery. It kind of messes them up. The first thing you do is play Indian chief. You set the TV in the middle of the bed, pull out rabbit ears and make a teepee out of the sheets. Start a fire in the bedpan and practice smoke signals. Number two, you print a sign, "Help, I'm a prisoner of a mad doctor," and you tie it to a urinal and throw it out the window and see how long it takes the police to arrive. You call the head nurse and ask if she's in charge of heads. You dump your apricot juice into the urine specimen bottle and your prune juice into the commode. You organize the rest of the patients in the mass sit-down on all the johns and commodes to ban all prune juice and enemas. When the nurse's aide comes pussyfooting in at 4:15 a.m. to bring fresh water and take your temperature, you jump out of bed and holler boo as loud as you can. Then you call the admitting office and admit something, like putting prune juice in the commode. You drag yourself to the nearest telephone, call the hospital disguising your voice, say you're a close friend of yourself, and thereby find out what your real condition is and when you're going to get out, if at all. Write friends' names on all the coupons you can find in all available magazines and newspapers and send them in. When too many visitors get too noisy or stay too long, call a nurse to bring in the commode. And when the visitors leave and the nurse pulls the curtain around you, leaving you alone with a commode with instructions to ring the call button when you're finished, don't ring it, but see how many hours, days, or weeks it takes for them to discover you. And the final thing, at the height of a visiting hour, put your hospital gown on backwards with the ties in front and drag yourself down the main hospital corridor. Now, one of the things that I had to do as dean was to get a lot of money, collect up a lot of money. That's what you spend most of your time doing. Now, we were successful and good in quite a bit of money, but it was usually designated for what it was given. And I had heard that at that time, Playgirl was really big. I mean, and they were paying pretty good money for articles in it, and really big money for the centerfold. So, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Now, I'm not going to talk about my successes because some of the failures are more interesting. This is from Playgirl, New York, New York, 10021. Dear Dean Busted, we wish to thank you for your letter and pictures which we recently received. However, we'll not be able to...
Maybe I should go to something else.
I have trouble seeing. However, we will not be able to use your body in our centerfold. On a scale of 0 to 10, your body was rated a minus 2. The rating is done by a panel of women ranging in age from 65 to 70 years. We tried to have our panel of women in the 25 to 35 year old bracket rate, but we couldn't get them to stop laughing long enough. Should the taste of American women ever change so drastically that they would want you in the centerfold, you will be notified by this office. In the meantime, however, don't call us, we'll call you. Sympathetically, signed Amanda Smith, editor, Playgirl magazine. So I treasure the letter. Now, we got two more things. We got to go through some slides very rapidly. A lot of you have been asking where Pullman is. Pullman is up there in the great northwest in the state of Washington. And I always say about Pullman, it isn't the end of the world, but you can see it from there. Now, the other day you learned that Jesus was not Norwegian. But on May 18th, 1980, I deduced that God is Norwegian. Because had he been anything else, he would not have Mount St. Helens come on May the 18th, the day after the biggest celebration on earth, the 17th of May in Norway. But he waited till May the 18th, you see. Anybody else would have had it May 17th. And I should say that writing there is in Chinese. And it's a curse. May you live in interesting times. And many people today are something like this. They want to stop the world and get off. Huh? And I have been involved in many revolutions, and we live in time of revolution. And we have three revolutions that greatly impact me in recent times. After I was somewhat involved, the results of the fission of the atom, you know, some of the most exciting times in history, and the developments in biology in my lifetime than any time heretofore in all of history. And they were exciting times. We live now in a computer and other high-tech revolution. And this has caught up with me. But I'm not one of the great proponents, although I've been using computers when I went involved with General Electric Company starting in 1950. And here I'm predicting, a lot of people predict the future. I got my crystal ball on the computer. A lot of people worship the computers. I am not one who worships a computer or bow to the great God computer. When we first started this, it's not 1930, it should be 1950, 60, 70, 74. And what most of it was air conditioning at that time. And I said, I'm visiting with a friend, I said, there seems to be a recurring theme. And something I can carry around in my pocket now, filled a whole building when I first started a computer. Dean Busted, the computer says you've been kicking it. And I say that's only circumstantial evidence. I'm glad to see someone else is put off by computer digital watches. Now, I can't knock them completely because, as some of you may not know, the first computer was developed in Norway. My parents made it in Norway, and it has most of the components, although some Norwegians only count to five. But the memory is there, you see, and the clear, and so it is. I am proud that Norwegians did invent them, at any rate. But they still cause me much trouble. It would certainly be a lot easier, Mrs. Letts, if you would pay the $8,240 bill for spaying your cat than for us to find the error in our computer. And now we hear a lot about artificial intelligence. We've been talking about do animals think? Well, they say computers think, but won't give that credit to animals. The bull is mixed up here. He thought this was stood for artificial insemination. It's really artificial intelligence. And the thing about computers, they're driving a lot of people crazy because they're unforgiving. And if you're an idiot, you're an idiot, you know. I have a solution to that, which I'll show you in a little while. Now, that's enough for computers. The other one is this whole high tech and bioengineering and those developments. And a lot of people now are looking at making cows with a long tenderloin, for example. And it isn't easy to do that. In fact, I got a call one day from a horse people. They raised jumpers, and they wondered if they could get a gene out of a rabbit and incorporate. And here you see, you can take a couple of zebras there and come out with something you can play tit-tat-toe on. So that's the extent of bioengineering for you. I'm spending the rest of my days on something else. I had to show you this because we were talking about an acquaintance of mine named Conrad Lorenz. And I use this in paying tribute to him in his 80th birthday. In a conference in Vienna, he was a Nobel laureate for his work on animals. And here you see, geese made him famous, and he made geese famous. He was a very interesting person. He died recently. In fact, I was involved in paying tribute to him at an international conference last November at Monaco. Back when many years ago, when I was involved early in my days in research, in fact, I guess I was sort of an average youth, but I was very interested in things and quite curious, really. And like if you see a wet paint sign, you know, you'd touch it. Is it really wet? And that's a sign of a scientist, you see. And one of the things that impressed me in my home was old Erickson. And he had sheep. Everybody else had dairy cows, but he had sheep. And I felt sorry for him because, you know, he'd get the wool and the lambs, but then he wasn't getting a check the rest of the year. With dairymen, at least you're working all the time, but you usually get a milk check. So I felt sorry for Emil. And I thought, you know, when I go off to college, wouldn't it be nice if you could cross a bear with a sheep? And that way, you see, during all the winter months, you'd have them in hibernation, so you wouldn't be feeding them. And so when I got off to Washington State College, we set up the experiment, but it failed because there wasn't enough wool on the bear end to, I mean, on the sheep end to cover the bear end. A lot of my life was spent with pigs. Some of you had already figured that out. Here was quite an interesting experiment. We're really happy there because we finally found something that doesn't cause cancer. And that isn't easy. Here's one experiment I had to cancel. See, these guys, they're really happy because they're really onto something. They think they've found something that will lead to immortality. But I had to cancel it because I told them it would take forever to test it. And all experiments don't work out right. You can lay good plans, but they don't always come out right. Now, I gave up research because I was losing neurons pretty fast. Here, Terry, can you remember the name of that lady that is always forgetting things? So that's where I'm coming from now. And now, what I did about people with computers, I have programmed this computer, and it's called a pet computer. And when you're stupid and you mess up, there's program to say pet the dog, and this dog is wired so you turn it on, and it gets warm, and its tongue gets wet, and if you pet it, everybody knows now that if you have an animal that you can pet that's warm and fuzzy, your anxiety level drops, your blood pressure falls. And a lot of good things happen to you. So that's why I promote this pet computer. But there's an easier way to do it. Get a dog or a cat for your computer room and the people there. This guy, I don't know if I got something to say about him or not. We'll look and see. Yeah, we got something. This guy is a real Mozart. What he does is, for $35, and you describe your animal, he'll write a ditty about it. And some of them are pretty catchy tunes. And when I find my flashlight, I'll give you one of the tunes. I've already shared some of this with the Elder Hostels, but his name is Nick, K-N-I-C-K. And he didn't think that the shark in Jaws got a fair shake. So he wrote a cheerful song about and called it the Shark's Song. I am a shark, a great white shark, swimming after you. I wish I could walk across the land, then I'd eat your grandmother too. And things like that. So you, for $35, you can get it. He's written some pretty good ones. I haven't got time to tell you all about them, but if you're interested, you can contact me afterwards. Now, let's see. What's next? And now you meet not only some interesting people in my business, but you meet some interesting animals. And this is kind of a rare, I bet most of you haven't seen this. All right, now we need the lights again, and then I'll have one more slide. We got still a few minutes, but if you get tired, you can go on. But one of the things that's interesting to me, and I won't give you the whole lecture on it, are ties. I don't know if you've thought about it, but ties are really pretty useless kind of a thing. It's an investment in resource that doesn't do much for you. I often wear a bow tie, and I've gotten some dandies. I won't have time to go into them all, but I'll never forget. I almost stopped the choir. In our bicentennial year, I was invited to give a talk in my home church in Stanwood, Washington. I had a blue suit on, and I had a frilly red, white, and blue frilly shirt, and then this flag, which is the 13 stars for the original, and I had this on. And it was a rainy day, and I had my raincoat on, and I went into the church and met them back, the pastor and the assistant. And they were deciding, you know, who should go in first. And they thought, well, maybe I should go in first. But then I took off my coat, and then they changed their mind. They thought I ought to go last. And the choir was already over there. The congregation is down. Well, the congregation is here, and the choir is here, and we were back here. And so I came in last, and the choir was singing, and they looked up at me and almost stopped. So I've had a lot of fun with that. And the students often give me, this is one that's even got a zipper in it here. And that's a pretty attractive one, I think. But this was a real dandy. It's kind of worn out now. It even had a battery in it, and it lit up and blinked. It was the class of 1984. It was a real beauty when in its heyday, but it's worn out from showing people. Sometimes they become innovative. Pigs are beautiful. Somebody, I have just tons of these. Then of course I have a pig tie. I have several of those, bow ties, and one of my children gave me this. You can wear it both ways. It's reversible, so that's kind of handy. But sometimes I wear the other kind. And you can have ties for a lot of occasions. Sometimes people don't do you a service. They give you something that's candidates for the white elephant sale, or what you can give to somebody you sort of wonder about. You know, isn't that a creation? I mean, I hope somebody isn't here that gave it to me. But I've worn them. I'll say that much. How's that for a belly warmer? Boy, that's that glows at night. That's a dandy. I hope some of you noticed, you Norwegians. I came here with matched luggage. Two brown paper sacks is matched luggage in Norway. And then I have a lot of ties that are sort of, well, are gifts from various places. Birdwatcher gave me this. Beautiful. A lot of beautiful birds on it. But I'm watching you, birdwatchers. I want to keep that. When I taught at the University of Illinois, they gave me one for Illinois. When I was in Australia, they gave me one with what kind of a bear on it? They're really not bears. Koala bears. And one for the Australia. So I got all kinds of those from various things, for various reasons. And some are purposeful, that are very handy depending on where you're going to go. Like if you speak to the fisherman, you have this tie, goes around. You see there are lures and flies in there. You see some really dandies. This is the kind you'd give to Rudy, but you wouldn't put these spoons in there. You'd just put flies. But that's pretty handy. But I've never seen anybody fishing wearing one of these. Of course, if you're in the pig business, you have a pig tie. I almost lost this John. Who was that halfback for the Washington Redskins? John, pardon? Yeah, Johnny Riggins. He's a real pig man. And he wanted to wrestle me for this, so I agreed I'd buy him one. But he's from Kansas, and he's really hot for pigs. And I sent him some stuff on pigs that he really liked. When you go to the dairyman, you wear the Holstein tie, because most of them are Holsteins now, and you better not show up at the Jersey Club, though, with it. If you go to talk to Republicans, wear one with elephants. And you say, well, what do you wear for the Democrats? Well, they usually don't wear ties. What do you do for the Scandinavians? Well, you wear a turtleneck. You know why you wear a turtleneck? Hide your flea collars. That's why Scandinavians wear them. You hide your flea collars. If you talk to the bird people, ducks, you have one with a duck. If you talk to the molecular biologist or the nuclear fission people, you have a lovely silk tie with all of the things on it. If you talk to the woodsman, I'll tell you, that's black walnut. Isn't that a beauty? I think it'd look good with me. It goes with my head. And but if you've thought about it, ties are useless, except to use up resources. And they're not utilitarian at all. And then you spill gravy and soup on them. And then unless you're going to be a slob, you got to clean them, and that takes resources too. So what we did was we invented a tie. I have them now in many colors. This was the original one. You see, it has a zipper here, and you carry notes in it, and it's big enough to carry a hot water bottle in it so you can have a belly warmer. It's also big enough, you see, so you can put, if you're going to talk to the Weight Watchers Club for lunch, you carry a sandwich. And you can also have some dessert in here. Well, I see there's some peanuts, some dessert, some candies. And it's nice to have that, because more and more people don't give you dessert anymore. I don't know if you've noticed that, but another thing about it is that if you do it right, you see, you can have that hole open, and you catch your gravy and soup in here, and all you got to do is, you know, clean it, you just zip it up. There's another thing about these. If you wear them to a cocktail party, which is the bane of my existence, before the night is out, somebody will come up to you and put his arm around you and say, "Hey, buddy, the fly on your tie is half open." That's a beauty, isn't it? My wife made both these ties for me. And if you tell me they're lovely, she'll appreciate that. She'd rather not be with me when I use them, however. And the students always do things in a big way. So the students gave me this. This has a big pocket. Zip goes from here to here. The last tie, which I'll be wearing on Thursday night for the Vespers, is a very special tie that I wear for special occasions. You see, the animals go both ways. And this has very special meaning for me because our late daughter Karn painted it for me, and it's the animals that I've worked with. And so that's sort of dedicated to her, and any time I use it, I sort of dedicate that evening to her. She was great for celebrations, loved Holden, and spent a lot of time here. And we set up, as some of you know, contributed to not only a fellowship in Cameroon where she died, but also here to help third world students that are in this country to come here and spend time. It has been very meaningful for many people. And in honor of her memory, I will close with a paragraph reading from the book Dancing in Africa, which are some of her letters. And with this we'll close. Speaking of a dream, I had a strange one the other night. I was at a village market and saw a man holding up some clothes for sale, the long white robes that men wear here. All of a sudden I felt such a longing, a deep craving for a white robe like that. The sun was hitting the robe so that it shone brilliantly white, almost blinding me with the reflection it was giving off the sun. I went stumbling up to the man asking how much it was. I was sure that if I could wear a robe like that, so white, whiter than snow, I would somehow be closer to Jesus. But then I really realized that wearing a white robe wouldn't do the trick, that it had to go deeper than that. And in a way, when I turned away from the man and left the robe there, I was disappointed. It would be so much easier to wear a white robe, wouldn't it, than to have a pure heart. I'll never forget that dream. It was so vivid. And 54 days later, she died. And that closes the evening. Thank you.